I'm going to be talking about the actual implementation of cryptographic pairing, right? And I'm very much focused on that. My interest is in implementing them and implementing them as quickly as possible, right? So I'm going to stay rigorously on that line, right? Calculating them as quickly as possible. So let's just do the recap bit. Of course, what it's all about is bilinearity. There's lots of interesting protocols that are enabled by pairings, but the property of pairings that enables those protocols is this bilinearity property, right? And it's really just to introduce the notation that I'll be using there. Which pairing to use? One thing about pairing-based crypto is the sheer number of choices involved, right? Different types of pairings, different embedding degrees, etc., etc., right? There's an awful lot of potential dimensions to it, so there's an awful lot of choice that's there. So picking the right thing there's a lot of decisions to be made. But as regards the choice of pairing, in my relentless pursuit of maximum performance, speed, it would seem that at the moment anyway, the Tate pairing and its variance is the best way to go. Right? The alternative is, of course, the Vail pairing. That is also a perfectly valid way of doing it, but it would appear at the moment anyway that the Tate pairing is fastest. Therefore, in this talk, I'm going to focus primarily on it. Where do pairings exist? Well, they exist on ordinary elliptic curves, a prime characteristic, and they exist on supersingular curves, right? And that's basically it at the moment. One of the nice, interesting, open questions in pairing-based crypto is to find pairings in other settings. For example, in a curve of small characteristic, let's say characteristic 2, pairing-friendly curves do exist. It's easy to find toy examples of them, but no one apparently knows any way of finding examples of cryptographic size, right? So for the moment, anyway, they're out, right? But on the supersingular curves, both over elliptic curves and hyperelliptic curves, there's plenty of settings there in which we can calculate pairings. But what I'm going to focus on today will be on ordinary elliptic curves, non-supersingular elliptic curves of prime characteristic. Right? So I say there's a lot of choices to make. I have to kind of settle on one, otherwise I'll be going off in all kinds of directions. So that's the one I'm going to settle on for this talk. But most of the optimizations I'm going to be talking about, ways of speeding up the pairing, apply equally to the supersingular setting as well. Right, let's look at all the players here. We have a P is a point of prime order R, just some notation. Q is a point over on an elliptic curve over an extension field, right? And of course, one thing that pairing-based crypto gets us into is extension field mathematics, right? Because all this really happens over extension fields, right? You can, of course, have pairings for K equals 1, and the embedding degree of K equals 1, but that's not that efficient in my view. In my view, the future lies with, in fact, even values of K, and 2 would be the minimum. Right, what is this embedding degree K? Well, it's the smallest K, and this is keep an eye on this definition because I'll be referring to it later. It's the smallest K such that R divides Q to the power of K minus 1. And of course, in my setting, I've already decided that Q is equal to P. Right, so that notation will change shortly and Q will become P. The pairing itself evaluates as an element in the finite extension field. Right, the kth extension. Right, now, how do we calculate the pairing? Well, let's look at, in the beginning, if you like, there was Miller's algorithm, right? And Miller's algorithm, everything is really based on that. So this is my take on Miller's algorithm, really stripped down and made as simple as possible. In fact, I've left bits out, which I'll point out later on, right? So it's stripped down as simple as I could make it, right? Because it's a nice way to be able to talk around it. Let's just take it from the top. We have our two inputs. P is an element of an elliptic curve, a pairing-friendly elliptic curve of embedding degree K, right, over the kth extension. Q is a similar kind of point. The point P has prime order R, right? We're going to calculate the pairing, EP, Q. Now, if you just look at the algorithm, it consists of two main parts. We have what I call the main Miller loop, right, that for loop, and we call it the Miller loop in honor of Miller. We have this variable F, which I call the Miller variable, right? We initialize a point T to the first parameter P, right? And then inside of this loop, well, there seems to be a lot going on. The one thing that's going on is we're doing a simple double and add algorithm on the point P. Basically, we're multiplying the point P by its order R. Right? And if you multiply a point P by its order R, you know exactly where you're going to end up. You're going to end up at the point at infinity. Right? So that's what's happening here to the elliptic curve, here and here. And it's a classic double and add algorithm. Right? Nothing particularly unusual about that. Right? In the meantime, the Miller variable F is undergoing this kind of treatment. Right? Here it's been squared. Here we got the line function and the vertical function, and I'll talk about them in a minute. Right? You can see that the the line function here, just the notation here, basically the line, this line, we'll see it in a minute, is generated from the process of adding t to t. Right? So that's why we've got t comma t here. Right, and here's where we actually do it. Here's the vertical line is to do with that as well. Right, I'll come up with another diagram in a minute that will make that a little bit clearer. At the end here, we have what's called the final exponentiation, where we take the final value of our Miller variable f after we've come out of the Miller loop, and we raise it to this power, the power of p to the k minus 1 over r. Right, and that is basic, stripped down, simplified version of the Tate pairing. The inputs are P and Q. The output is this value F. P is a point of order R. And one of the nice things that the pairing algorithm does, P is a point of order R. And if you like, the output is a point in the finite field of the same order. Right? One of the first uses of pairings, of course, was to take the discrete logarithm problem over the elliptic curve, right, over the point P, for example, and modify it to a discrete logarithm problem over the extension field. And that's the basic MOV and Frey-Ruck insight. But one further thing I'd like to point out about this algorithm is there seems to be actually three inputs that you need. You need P and Q, but it also seems that you also need R. Right? You need the group order R. Now, in fact, you actually don't. You can actually change this algorithm again, and instead of having R in there, have P to the power k minus 1 in there P to k minus 1 in there instead of R, and delete the final exponentiation altogether. Alternatively, you can mess around with it. You can increase the value. You can have 2R there instead of R, and then have divided by 2R down here instead. Right? And you get exactly the same answer. Right? Knowing the order of the point P simply speeds things up, because it's probably better to do more work down here than do it in here. Right? So we try and push as much as we can into the final exponentiation, because hopefully this will be a faster calculation than going around that loop too many times. Right? But the point is, you don't actually need to know R in order to calculate the pairing value. It helps. It speeds things up a bit. Right, now, you've all seen that before, right? Elliptic curve 101, point doubling, the classic example over the rails, and we demonstrate here a point doubling. There's the formula for doing it. All very familiar with that. But Xavier had a nice diagram, so I thought I'd have a nice one too. And this is the pairing algorithm, if you like. And I always thought if someone writes a textbook on pairings, this would look really nice on the front cover. Right? Kind of introduces all the main components and allows you to describe all the main parts of the pairing algorithm in quite an elementary way, and you can actually see what things are. For example, the line function is simply that vertical distance there, that distance from the point Q drop down to the line. Right? So if we're doing a point doubling, that's the classic way of doing it, an elliptic curve. You take the tangent line and then you drop the vertical. Right? Well, those line functions associated with that operation are those two distances there. There's the line value, and there's the what we call the vertical value. Confusingly, the vertical value is a horizontal distance, but we think of it as the distance involving the vertical line, right? Hence the name V. Right? And that's how you actually calculate it. The point Q has coordinates xq and yq. Right? Lambda is the slope of the line. Xj and yj, that's the current coordinates of the point t. Right? Remember, this point t has been whipped all the way around to the point at infinity, so this is just a snapshot of its progress. Right? And those distances then are the line and vertical values that we need in the algorithm. Right? So hopefully that explains these components here and here. Right. So there's the basic pairing algorithm. Now, as I've described it, I've been a little bit naughty, right? Because the thing can fall over. The algorithm can collapse in a bit of a heap if, for example, this distance should become zero. Or indeed, if that line should go straight through the cue point, right? There's a number of ways in which the algorithm can collapse and fail to compute the correct answer. The standard way of fixing Miller's algorithm to avoid that from happening is introduce another value, R, a random value, right, which doesn't change the value of the pairing, but kind of gives the calculation a knock, if you like, to prevent this from happening. Right, so that's I've left that out because in later variations on the pairing algorithm, that won't be an issue. Right, so I've left it out just to keep things simple as I can. Right. So let's start off with some nice simple optimizations, some nice easy ones to limber up with before we move into the more elaborate ones. Some of them are pretty obvious, right? For example, the group order R is a choice. When we decide on our pairing-friendly curve, to an extent, we get to create R, right? So it would seem to make sense to minimize the number of times we go into this if clause, try and keep the Hamming weight of R as small as possible, right? And so let's try and do that. That's a fairly obvious idea. And indeed, we can use that point I made earlier that we don't actually have to use R. We can use any multiple of R which divides that. So if we have a multiple of R which has a low Hamming weight, we can use that as well. Right? So in one way or another, we certainly hope to get a low Hamming weight value for R. Right? In some cases, that may not be possible. Right? In some of the families of pairing friendly curves, like the MNT curves, you don't have that much choice over R. In fact, the MNT curves are so rare, you don't have much choice about anything, really. So in that case, you just have to take the R value you're given, in which case classic windowing algorithms can be used. There's also an idea by Eisentrager, Leuter, and Montgomery, which can be useful in this setting. However, for the moment, I'm going to make the assumption that we can choose a low Hamming weight R. Right, I think in a lot of cases we actually can. Right, now let's move on now to a second optimization. The second one is an obvious one in a sense. Indeed, these two are, I would describe them as fairly obvious. This time we choose P from the elliptic curve over the base field, as I call it. Right, which we're quite at liberty to do. This Salinas named this rather nicely Miller Light. Right, which is a nice way to describe it. The way I've described it, by the way, I was using affine coordinates, but projective coordinates actually may well be faster, because in that point multiplication, where we're taking the point P to the point at infinity, all those point additions and doublings, on the face of it, we use affine coordinates that involve field inversions. Field inversions can slow us down. Remember, I'm trying to go as fast as possible here. So it's probably more useful to use projective coordinates. One thing we won't do is we won't choose, and when we're choosing our parameters, we won't choose the prime modulus itself to be of low Hamming weight. Right? Now, that's potentially a good idea, because when we're doing modular arithmetic, when we have to find we have to reduce a product of two elements mod p, we could certainly, from a software engineering or from a software point of view or a hardware point of view, we might be able to do it quicker if P itself has low Hamming weight. And some of the families of pairing-friendly curves, to an extent, allow you to do that. They allow you to choose a value of P which could have a low Hamming weight. However, it's been, I think, demonstrated, at least my interpretation of a recent preprint by Schirachauer, is that that practice is to be deprecated, because it potentially will impact on our security, right? And when I said I was single-mindedly going after speed here, I mean, there's things I won't do, right? Making the thing potentially insecure is a place that we don't really, it's not a direction we want to go in, right? So as things stand, P will not be of low Hamming weight, right? Because we'll try and make the discrete logarithm problem as hard as we possibly can. As well as introducing optimizations as we go along, I'm going to introduce certain restrictions. And my first restriction here is the K should be even. Right? It doesn't have to be, And I'm nervous about introducing too many restrictions because, as we'll find out later, pairing-friendly curves aren't all that numerous, right? We can't afford to exactly pick and choose or be too picky about it, right? Because there's not that many of them. So I don't want to make too many restrictions, but this is one I will make because it really pays off. We'll assume that the embedding degree K is an even number and it's 2 times D, right? The second and the final thing I'm going to do is that final exponentiation, I'm going to break it up into two components for reasons that will become apparent later. So this is my first tentative optimization to the basic algorithm. And you can see the changes are highlighted in red, and I haven't really changed very much yet. Basically, I've done the Miller-Lyte idea. P is over the elliptic curve over the base field. That's certainly going to help because these point multiplications then are going to be much faster. Right, sorry, point additions, point doublings are going to be much faster. R is low Hamming weight, so I'm going to come in here relatively rarely. Right, and that's going to speed things up. That final thing I did was down here. I divided the final exponentiation into two parts. Right, and if K is even, clearly we can do this. And clearly from the definition of the embedding degree K, it's clear that the order R divides this part, not that part. Sorry? Yeah. K is 2D. Sorry, K is equal to 2D. So we can split the final exponentiation like this into two parts. Right? And the reason for that will become clear later. I'm just setting something up here that'll happen in a slide or two. Right, so there's our first tentative operations. Looking at this from an implementer's point of view, where do we see the problems? Well, one thing I don't like at all is this. I don't like that. Right, extension field divisions, bad news. Right, I'd really rather not have that. So that's something that catches my eye. This could be potentially quite time-consuming. Right, but we haven't finished yet. There's a whole battery of optimizations. To do yet. Well, one point I'd like to make is whenever pairing suddenly became popular and suddenly people became interested in implementing them as quickly as possible, a lot of the early results are really to an extent relatively obvious, relatively easy, right? So there was a lot of simultaneous discovery. There's a full paper goes with this talk and I give the URL at the end of it. And I hope in that full paper I've given correct credit to whoever actually published first. Right, but there may be some contention about this, and if anyone sees any errors in it or wants to correct it, I would quite happily do that. Right, because a lot of these discoveries, they came in a kind of a rush, if you like. David Nakash has a nice expression about research. He says, he talks about low-hanging fruit. And in this case, some of the low-hanging fruit was so low-hanging it was dragging along the ground. You know, it was really obvious stuff. You know, so just be aware of that. Okay, now I'm going to digress. I'm going to go on a fairly hefty digression, and I'm going to digress into the area of extension field arithmetic because suddenly this has become important. In RSA, it's not important. People implementing public key crypto haven't really concentrated on this too much. Well, they have to an extent. There are a couple of contexts there which are schemes which I think have been relatively heavily implemented. One example would be the XTR scheme, which uses extension field arithmetic in implementation. The other would be optimal extension fields for elliptic curves. Right there, we also use extension field arithmetic. However, it's not quite what we're facing here. In the XDR case, they don't really go much above the quadratic extension. In optimal extension fields, the modulus can be of special form, low Hamming weight, and typically as well, the modulus would be of word size, 32-bit or 64-bit. So that's, in a sense, it's a little bit different as well. So in a way, we're kind of into relatively fresh territory here. So let's now have a brief canter through extension field arithmetic. And we'll start off with the simplest case, which is for k equals 2. Right? K equals 2, we represent elements in the extension field with respect to what we call an irreducible polynomial. Right? And there's an example that we're going to use. If p is congruent to 3 mod 4, we can choose simply x squared plus 1 as our irreducible polynomial. Then elements in fp squared can be represented as a plus xb. Right? There's a polynomial, a degree 1 polynomial. Right, where A and B are in FP. Right? Now, this is sounding a little bit strange to people who are implementing crypto. Let me get you back onto safe ground again. Because a nice way to consider it is let X equals I, which of course doesn't change anything. But basically, we extract, if you like, the root of the irreducible polynomial. So we can regard then I as being the square root of minus 1, if you like, by solving the irreducible polynomial. In which case, we can represent things like A plus IB. And suddenly everything's just like complex arithmetic. Which is a lovely, friendly cosy environment to be in, because we all know how complex arithmetic works. And the analogy is almost, well, it is exact to a sense. It works, the arithmetic works exactly like complex arithmetic. Right, and for the case P equals 3 mod 4, we can choose that irreducible polynomial. In the other case, we may have to use x squared plus 2 or some other variation, but the basic idea still holds. Right, so how do we do extension field arithmetic? Well, we do multiplication, of course. Karatsuba is going to be our friend. Right, we multiply two elements like this, a plus ib upon c plus id. Well, that's how you do it. It's basically Karatsuba, and you can see we're only actually doing 3 mod moles. Right, there, and there, because we calculated those two values already. So just 3 mod moles, which is better than the 4 that you'd get doing it in the naive way. Right. However, recall that our modulus p isn't special. Right. So by costing this thing in terms of mod moles, we're actually doing ourselves a bit of a disservice. Right. So for example, when you calculate ac minus bd, the obvious, if you like, way to do it would be calculate ac mod p, then BD mod P, and subtract them. But it actually makes more sense to calculate AC and BD, then subtract them, and then do the modulo reduction. So you only do the modulo reduction once. Right? Now, this is quite a common idea. This is called, I think somebody called it rather nicely, lazy reduction. Sorry, not using? Oh, no, even if you're using Montgomery, you can do this. So the overall cost then is two multiplications and one reduction. So overall you can cost the multiplication approximately 2.5 mod moles, where a mod mole is a multiplication and a reduction. So if we're using that as our price, if you like, our currency, this then costs two and a half roughly. How about squaring? Well, squaring, of course, we have this identity. Again, well known to implementers of complex arithmetic. Right? Perhaps not so well known to people implementing finite arithmetic, but still fairly obvious. I don't think many people would have missed that one. Right? This, the cost of this is clearly just 2 mod moles. Right? So that's quite nice. Things are getting, as we went from the base field to the quadratic extension, things have got a little harder, but asymptotically, if you like, not a too bad of a way. We've got 2.5 times harder, which is a lot better than 4 times harder, and here we're only 2 times harder. Right? So that would appear to be the way to do it. What about, let's just stretch ourselves out now into completely, well, relatively virgin territory. What about the cubic extension field? Right? In the cubic extension field, let's give ourselves an irreducible polynomial x cubed plus n. Right, so we're kind of extending. We're not in this is not complex arithmetic anymore. We're in the kind of, you know, this is a little bit different. Right here, when we're doing the field multiplications, for example, we can use Karatsuba for 6 mod moles, or we can use Toom-Cook. Right, Toom-Cook just costs 5 mod moles. Toom-Cook you might want to reject, because you might say Toom-Cook has tricky divisions by constants, which indeed it does. However, this is where the context in which we're doing it comes to our rescue, because remember the final exponentiation. Right, let's just trot back. Oops. Right, remember the final exponentiation down here? Whatever this f thing is going to end up as, we're going to multiply, we're going to raise to the power of f to the power of d minus 1. Now, p to the power of d minus 1 has as a factor p minus 1. Therefore, whatever this thing evaluates as, we're going to be raising it to the power of p minus 1. And of course, raising something to the power of p minus 1 knocks out all the constants, because of Fermat's small theorem, they all go to 1. They all get wiped out. Right, so that means that Toom-Cook isn't as bad as it seems, because all those tricky divisions can be replaced by multiplication, right? Exploiting the context in which we're doing it. Right, so that means that Toom-Cook, which ordinarily you wouldn't really look at from an implementer's point of view, suddenly it's in contention again. And we're in the process, I have a group of people who are actually doing lots and lots of tests on this, trying to figure out the best way of doing it, and that process is not yet complete. Lazy reduction on the face of it also applies. Although it's not the panacea that it might seem to be, because the amount of additions that get involved really eventually overwhelm the extra savings. So there's again a sweet spot there, and I'm not quite sure where it is. What about squaring in the cubic extension? Well, to illustrate that this is a relatively unexplored area, I had a way of doing it with 3 mod squares and 1 mod mole, and I was looking through the CACR preprint website, and I saw a paper by Chung and Hassan. And they managed to do it in 4 mod squares and 1 mod mole, which is a result I missed altogether. So that only was a very recent result. So I didn't know that. Let me just digress beyond my digression and go somewhere else. an extension field arithmetic, what about square roots? Are they important? Well, they might be. And Bonnie and Franklin IBE, I think Xavier was talking about hashing onto an elliptic curve point. If you have to do that over a quadratic extension, then you need to calculate square roots, right? So how do you calculate square roots over a quadratic extension? Well, that's the way to do it. I really just brought this in because I saw a paper recently, I think was it by Wang, Nunogima, and Murakawa, and they had a very elaborate way of doing square roots over quadratic extensions. That formula comes, again, directly from complex arithmetic literature. If you Google complex arithmetic square roots, you'll find that formula, right? And of course, it works perfectly fine over the finite field as well. And it has some interesting characteristics. For example, notice that's exactly the same as that, and that's exactly the same as that, so the cost is only 2 square roots. Right, so if you have to calculate a square root over a quadratic extension, you only have to calculate 2 square roots over the base field. Right? The other interesting thing about this is that is this value a quadratic residue or not? Well, it is, if and only if, that's a quadratic residue. And I leave it to you as an exercise. The proof is quite simple. Right? And that has interesting implications as well. I'll come back to that in a second. What about square roots in cubic extensions? Right. Well, I don't have a closed formula for doing that. It'd be nice to have one, but I don't have one. I tried hacking it out on the back of an envelope once, ended up with this horrible sextic, which I couldn't really do anything with, so I gave it up. Right. So couldn't really get anywhere with that. So where do we go with all this when we're implementing pairings? Well, typically we're working in extension fields, k values. They aren't 2. Well, typically it can be 2, but it could be 2. It could be for M&T curves. It could be 6. For BEN curves, it could be 12. How are we going to construct these extension fields? Well, the smart way to do it is to use a tower of extension. A tower of extensions. Basically build an extension on top of an extension. And the formulas for multiplication, inversion, indeed that square rooting formula, can all be applied recursively. So we can build a little recursive tower, so the code at the higher level is really quite simple. Right? So we build one layer on top of another. Right? So for example, for a sextic extension field, x to the power 6 plus m, which you might use with an MNT curve, we could use a cubic extension on top of a quadratic, right? In which setting, squaring only requires 11 mod moles using the Chung-Hassan result, and that's not including the possibility of lazy reduction, right? Interestingly, if you imagine, let's say you're doing square roots over the field p to the power of 2 to the power of d, right? And let's say you wanted to determine quadratic residuosity. Right. Well, it turns out that to calculate quadratic residuosity, you have to calculate, well, that's a quadratic residue. Right? So that takes you down to the layer below. Right? And then you go down to the layer below, so you get this nice recursion all the way down to the bottom. So determining whether this is a quadratic residue, irrespective of the value of d, depends only on a simple calculation of the Jacobi symbol over the base field, right down at the bottom. Right? So that's interesting. Okay, so that's a tower of extensions. Now, people, Jadot, for example, Koblitz and Menezes proposed that we should use irreducible polynomials of this form, right? And we can do that if we restrict p is equal to, I think, 1 mod 12, right? We can always find a value n for which this is irreducible, if p is congruent to 1 mod 12. And that's fine, but in practice, I have a few issues with that. First of all, I think that's a little too restrictive. I think it ties us down. We can't use, for example, p equals 3 mod 4 primes in this setting, right? So I think that's a little restrictive, and I find a better way to do it, as, for example, for the BN curves, and indeed Barreto and Neyrig suggested this themselves. If you're doing it for a k equals 12 curve, you're better off with a sextic extension, right, with that irreducible polynomial built on top of a quadratic with that irreducible polynomial. And you can see they both involve the square root of minus 2 in their solution. That makes the implementation very simple. Right, and that's a big issue. How do we organize the towering? Right, for k equals 12, we could organize it as a quadratic over a cubic over a quadratic. Right, and that'll give us k equals 12. Right, for an M&T curve, I mean, there's a few decisions to be made here. Do I do it as a 3 over 2 or do it as a 2 over 3? Right. Of course, you can swap from one to the other. It's trivial to change from one to the other, but it's nice to make the right decision at the beginning and stick to it, certainly in terms of speed. So there's some interesting design considerations there that need to be thought about. Another good friend in this kind of calculating pairings is, of course, the Frobenius. Of course, you'll all be familiar with it, but implementers sometimes overlook the power of it. Certainly, I did. Right, we have this identity, right? We're assuming k equals 2 in this case, and one implication of the Frobenius. So here, if we k equals 2, for example, a plus ib to the power of p is simply its own conjugate, right? So there's no cost at all, zero cost, right? So you can't get any better than that. And one of the implications of that is, if you need to raise an element of a quadratic extension, or even a powered quadratic extension, to a multiple of the modulus p, or something bigger than p, you don't have to. You can always reduce it modulo p and bring it back down again, right? So you never have to do an exponentiation to a value greater than p. You can exploit the Frobenius. Okay, now, we do pairings on pairy-friendly curves. So what's the story on pairy-friendly curves, and what are the parameters of interest associated with them? Well, here, the equations at the top you'll all be horribly familiar with. There are two parameters that are perhaps of particular interest when we're looking at pairy-friendly curves. One is what I call the rho parameter, and the other is what I call the omega parameter. The rho parameter is basically the number of bits in the prime modulus over the number of bits in the group order, right? Rounded to a whole number, typically. Right, I'll give you an example in a minute to give you an idea. This omega value turns out to be significant as well, and it's the number of bits in the group order divided by the number of bits in the trace of the Frobenius, right? In general, we would like rho to be small. Right, because a small value of rho means you're doing the minimum number of work in your point multiplication of your first parameter p to get a certain level of security associated with your embedding degree. Right, so indeed we might call such curves ideal pairing-friendly curves if we can find them with rho equals 1. Turns out that having a large omega is also going to be good for us. Let me explain. Let me give an example. The BN curves, a lovely family of pairing-friendly curves. Barreto and Mary. They have an embedding degree of 12. They have an extremely simple generation function, perhaps a little too simple, I think. Again, the Shirkauer's preprint, I think, raised some doubts that a simple generation function like that might in some ways make the discrete logarithm problem easier, but I'll let him talk about that. But it's a very simple generation function. It has a rho value of 1, which is ideal. It has an omega value of 2. How do I know rho is equal to 1? Because the degree is the same, right? So basically, another way of defining rho is that the degree of this and divided into the degree of that, right? And they're both the same. The omega is equal to 2 because this is 2 and that's 4, right? So 2 into 4 is 2, right? Omega is 2. It's not bad. In fact, there are other k equals 12 curves where you can get an omega equal to 4. And as far as omegas are concerned, the bigger the better, for reasons I'll come to. Some of these effects have interactions. In general, the smaller the value of rho, the harder it is to find a low Hamming weight value of r. In the BN curve case, you can see what the problem is. You generate some random value of x. Px must be a prime, right? You would like this to be a prime as well, right? So that's not going to happen, obviously, for the relatively rare values of x for which that occurs. And then you hope that this this will have a low Hamming weight. Right, and of course you can choose your extra low Hamming weight, which will give you a good advantage, but you can see it's not going to have a Hamming weight of 2 or 3. It's going to have something larger than that. So, but by some control over x, you can still do quite well and get a relatively small Hamming weight for r. Right? In this case, since this is a prime, this is r. Right, there are other types of pairing-friendly curves, of course. There are the Cox-Pinch curves, for which the rho value is 2, which is inferior. However, on the other hand, what you lose in the swings, you gain in the roundabout, you get effectively a free choice for r. You pick your own r. You can have a Hamming weight of 2 or 3 if you want. Right? But you suffer with a larger value of rho. Right, now let's get back to optimizations. Let's assume that our extension field, fp to the k, is built as a quadratic extension on top of fp to the power of d. Right? So now we can consider an element of fp to the k as a plus ib. Right? Now, what that immediately tells us, applying the Frobenius, that we have this relationship, and it's not difficult to see that we also have this relationship. Right? I'll let you check that yourselves in your own time. The significant thing about it is this. This value, raised to the power of p to the power of d minus 1, is the same as that value, raised to the power of p to the power of d minus 1. Right? This is inversion. This is the conjugate. right? So it turns out that following the final exponentiation, and remember this is part of the final exponentiation, that we can no longer distinguish inversions from conjugates, right? They're effectively the same thing. So how does that help us optimize our pairing? Well, we exploit the fact that we're doing that this down here, and we, if you like, push the effect of that back into the Miller loop, which immediately tells us that we can replace all those divisions by simple conjugates, right? And remember those expensive divisions that I talked about? Suddenly, they're not a problem anymore, right? They're gone. Right, so that was good. That was very handy. That's a very important optimization. But there's one thing I haven't exploited yet. What about the value of Q? Q is something, to an extent, I get to choose as well, right? So let's choose Q in the most beneficial possible way. Right, now, typically, in general, let's again assume at the A plus IB representation, right, XQ is A plus IB, YQ is equal to C plus ID, right? Now, let's restrict it instead to the case where B equals C equals 0, right? Now, if we do that, we instantly see that the vertical line functions are now completely in this field here, right, FP to Z, because if you look back at the line functions, you see they only involve X, and X, because B is equal to 0, is now completely in the base field. Right, so that means that the vertical line functions, right, that I just went to so much effort to express as conjugates here, if we choose Q in this particular way, right, the final exponentiation here basically wipes them all out. So it turns out you don't need them at all. Right, so there's my next change. You can see the vertical lines have gone, and this is the famous denominator elimination optimization. Right, very important one. And now we've really got a nice stripped down pairing. And we get two for the price of one because it turns out that the Q parameter can now be is now isomorphic to a point on the quadratic twist. Right? So we have a greatly simplified value way of dealing with Q. We can handle Q as a point on the quadratic twist over a much smaller extension. Right? So now we can, prior to calculating the pairing, Q can be manipulated much more quickly. All right, so now we're really getting places. Let's do a couple of quickies. The group order will always be odd. R will always be odd, since it's prime, which means on the last iteration, we're always going to execute that. But it turns out that this term here, again, gets wiped out by the final exponentiation. Right, so we don't have to bother with that final iteration. Right, and the final exponentiation itself can be further subdivided into three parts. For example, if k equals 6, p to the power of 6 minus 1 is equal to p to the power of 3 minus 1 upon p plus 1 upon p squared minus p plus 1. Again, because of the definition of k, r must divide that part. It doesn't divide the other two, right, from the definition of the embedding degree. Exponentiation by the first two parts is extremely quick using the Frobenius, leaving us with this hard bit to do at the end. Right, so now, there's our new look. I've removed that last iteration by a simple change there. I've again rejigged the final exponentiation, and these two bits now are dead easy applications of the Frobenius. This is the only bit of hard work that's left at the end. Right, again, use that idea of expressing the exponent to the base p. We can exploit the Frobenius and use multi-exponentiation, which is something I certainly completely missed, but it's a fairly nice optimization. And of course, in that context, because inverses can be treated as conjugates, as we saw, we can use an add subtract kind of algorithm, and we can do it even faster. Right, how am I doing for time? Am I
10 minutes?
Oh, that was, well, lost the run of me. Okay, I'll slow down again. Okay, an alternative way of handling the final exponentiation. Right, this bit at the end here, the hard part of it, is by, instead of using multi-exponentiation, we can use the Lucas or XTR exponentiation, right, which uses the full size of the exponent, but over a smaller field size, right? So this is basically what's known as pairing compression, right? When we use these methods, we can't actually reduce the exponent modulo p. That doesn't actually work. So we have to use the larger exponent, but what we gain is that we're working over smaller field sizes, right? And that, for smaller values of k, is, I think, the best way to go. And also, the fact that you can compress the value of the pairing is probably a good idea. It'll reduce bandwidth, it'll reduce storage. It's probably a good idea. Right. What about pre-computation? Okay, let's go back there again. And let's look at this algorithm again. We're trying to calculate E, P, comma, Q. What if P is known in advance? What if P is fixed? What if P is, for example, your IBE private key? Right? And it's fixed. It's not going to change. If P is fixed and it's not going to change, then this multiplication by the group order, all this doubling and adding, is all preordained. We know exactly where we're going. All these values, in other words, can be pre-computed and stored. Right? Now, is that a good idea? Is that going to help? Well, it certainly takes big chunks out of the algorithm. Basically, these just become lookups, right? So you can take them out. And for small values of k, that can be really advantageous. It really gives you a nice boost. For larger values of k, not so much, because remember, this point doubling and point addition is taking place over the smaller base field. This arithmetic here, f squared, and this multiplication is taking place over the larger extension field, which is k times bigger. So for larger values of k, the extension field arithmetic dwarfs the elliptic curve stuff. Right? But for smaller values of k, it's still a very useful and powerful optimization. Right? So that's, and in that case, of course, you can fall back and use affine coordinates since you're not calculating these points on the run. It's like you've got them all stored and calculated. You can use affine coordinates, which, again, can improve things a little bit. One little peephole optimization that I can mention is this multiplication here. It can turn out, in certain cases, that this value here is sparse to an extent, right, for certain values of k. So you have a special little multiplication algorithm, if you like, which exploits that fact to reduce the cost of that multiplication. Right, there's all kinds of tricks we can get up to. Right, I think I made that point already. Okay, here's a trick. In pairing-based protocols, there's often a requirement to raise the value of the pairing to a power v. So we calculate E, P, Q to the power of v. Right? Now, for whatever reason, you need to do that. If you like, one way of looking at this exponentiation to the value of v, it's an extension of the final exponentiation. Because remember, the last thing we were doing in here was an exponentiation. So why don't we just exponentiate a bit more? Right? And one idea is to take this extra exponent and simply include it, throw it into the multi-exponentiation. Right? Because you're doing a multi-exponentiation anyway, you can more or less throw it in there, and at almost no extra cost, you can calculate that. Right, so maybe that would make a better primitive than that if you can calculate it at potentially no extra cost. And for larger values of k, that works quite well. What about curve-dependent optimizations? Right now, as I pointed out earlier, this parameter omega may apply to certain families of pairing-friendly curves. For example, for the MNT curves, omega is equal to 2. And in these cases, as was recently discovered, there's a truncated loop variant of the pairing as possible, the so-called 8 pairing, right? Related to the Tate pairing, but it has certain advantages, certainly when omega is greater than 1, right? Here, this is really quite clever. We take the P and Q, as we had them before, and we swap them, right? And it's actually interesting to see the 8 pairing, because the changes are remarkably few. You can see we've taken P and Q, and we reversed their roles. Right, we've swapped their roles. The only other change I need to make is here. Right, this is now the trace instead of the value R. Right, so in that simple little change, this is still a pairing, still exhibits pairing behavior, right? Still a bilinear pairing, perfectly valid. Except you can see potentially huge savings because this loop is now, if omega is equal to 2, it's only half the length it was before. So we're only going around this half as many times. Of course, the final exponentiation is still the same, so we can't say we're twice as fast. But we're only going around that loop half as many times, right? And that's got to be a big win. Where potentially we might suffer is that the first parameter, the one that we're doing the doubling and adding to, is now over a higher extension, right? So we gain on the swings again. It seems that we've lost on the roundabouts, but there's another idea that Hess, Martin, Vercauteren came up with that ameliorates that, the impact of that. So this again comes under the heading of special particular families of pairing-friendly curves, so-called low CM discriminant curves. Curves, of course, when we find the curves, non-supersingular pairing-friendly curves, we have to use the method of complex multiplication to actually find them. There's no other known way of doing it. Right? Now, if those curves should have a low CM discriminant, say, of -1 or -3, it turns out we haven't just got quadratic twists, we've got quartic and sextic twists as well, right? And we can exploit that. And for the BN curves, where the discriminant, the CM discriminant, it turns out is -3. For the embedding degree, K is equal to 12. And we can use the sextic twist. So the point P, instead of being over FP to the power K over 2, right, which was 6, the sixth extension, is now only over the quadratic extension. Right? So now you can see the issue of P being over a higher extension isn't nearly as bad as it used to be, because now it's only over a quadratic extension instead of over a sextic extension. Right? So we're back in business again. Right, so the low discriminant types of pairing-friendly curves, and all pairing-friendly curves aren't like this. A lot of them are. A lot of the families of pairing-friendly curves fall into this category. They'll work quite well. And for many pairing-friendly curves, the discriminant, the CM discriminant, is -1 or -3. For example, the Brezing-Wayne curves, whole families of curves, have this particular characteristic. And what you can do is, for example, you can construct a K equals 6, D equals -3, pairing-friendly curve, and you can choose both P and Q to be curves over the base field FP. Right? One over the base field, one over its sextic twist. Right? So that's nice, because it means we're back in almost the case like in the supersingular curves, P and Q are now both over the base field. Right? That's really nice indeed. It's not hard to construct such a curve and get that working. The one downside of it is sometimes the types of pairing-friendly curves we would like to have, they don't actually exist, and we haven't managed to find them yet. Right? And the only pairing-friendly curves that I could find with this property, with K equals 6 and D equals -3, they had a row value of 2. Right? So it's not actually as nice as it looks. But still, it's an interesting observation. Right, one more trick. Let's consider the MNT curve, K equals 6. R is equal to number of points in the curve, and that's a prime. The hard part of the final exponentiation is to the power of p squared minus p plus 1 over r. Remember, that's the sixth cyclotomic polynomial. What's r? It's p plus 1 minus t. Now, if you look at that for a second or two, you'll see there's something quite nice happening here. Because if you divide that into that and get the remainder, you can see it divides almost exactly. That's p squared. Now, it's not hard to see when you do the division that you end up with the value p plus epsilon, where epsilon is very close to t. It's t plus or minus 1, I think, and it's very tightly tied to t. Right? So, and by regarding the exponent in this form, you can see this could be done with the Frobenius for nothing, and this is half length. It's half the length you would have expected. Right? So that's a nice little keyhole optimization that emerges. That means we only have the eighth pairing did we get the Miller loop truncated to half size, but it turns out in certain circumstances the final exponentiation is just half size. Right? So, as you can imagine, employing all these things, we're getting pairings to be faster and faster. Now, of course, pairings don't exist in isolation. We just don't calculate them for the crack, right? For a bit of a laugh, you know? We calculate them in the context of a protocol. Now, how does the... I've been focusing, if you like, too much on the pairing per se. Now we have to kind of connect it up to the protocol and see how well it's going to fit. Right, now, the protocol typically doesn't just consist of a pairing calculation. There's also typically point multiplications of the parameters, P and Q. And in that case, it'll help if P and Q are over smaller fields. Right? Or, of course, on the other hand, it may be that, like, take, for example, Boney and Franklin IBE, in which case, as part of the encryption process, there is a fixed point multiplication required. But hang on, the point is a generator point. It's a fixed point. Therefore, you can use well-known algorithms that for multiplication of fixed points with the pre-computation. And again, that almost doesn't contribute anymore. You're back basically to the cost of the pairing. Right? So you have to analyze the protocol actually quite closely to see where's the bottleneck. Is the pairing the bottleneck or what? Right? And we've got choices, as I said at the very beginning. If you want 1024-bit security, do you choose k equals 2 and p equals 512, or do you use k equals 6 and p approximately 160, or really 171, that should be. Right? On the face of it, they give you similar security levels. Which is faster? Well, in my experience, A is in fact faster. Right? For implementational, detail-y kind of reasons that I won't go into in too much detail. Right? However, if we have a pairing, let's say take the choice A, if we had to do a point multiplication, we end up having to do an elliptic curve point multiplication over a field of size 512 bits. And that's a bit ugly, right? Because normally we do elliptic curve point multiplications, we do it over 160 bits or something much smaller, right? Whereas in the second curve, that would be much friendlier. Short signature schemes must use the B alternative, otherwise the signatures won't be short, right? So there's lots of decisions. I don't know. I'm not coming up with a definitive answer. Yeah. Ooh. I'd have to think about that. I'll talk to you after. Right, scaling security. Much debated, right? There's been a couple of papers going backwards and forth, but I think everyone's more or less in agreement. Now, I just throw my hip worth in there when you actually implement it is that implementing higher extensions, the code is much fussier. Right, if you're doing a layered extension, right, like this, a powered extension, you spend more time going in and out of functions. Like, the great thing about RSA is it spends all its time doing a modular multiplication, a little inner loop buzzing around like that, which is great. Extensive field arithmetic, you're hopping in and out, you're doing a multiplication, then you're doing an addition, then you're doing a multiplication, you're kind of popping around all over the place. I can't use a much more scientific word than the word fussier. It is fussier, and that can be a problem. Especially if your cache size is small. If you've got a small instruction cache, hopping around like that's definitely not a good idea, and you suffer for it. Okay, let's scaling security. Oh, we can talk about that another time. Products of pairings, I won't talk too much about that. Some timings, right? All code in C and assembly language. We compare with 1024-bit RSA decryption because that's the gold standard. If I can show you can calculate a pairing almost as quickly as you can calculate an RSA decryption, maybe the people who say pairing-based crypto is no good, it's too slow, will maybe go a bit quieter, right? So we have to decide on something. Let's decide the group size of 160 bits, field size 1024 bit equivalent. We're going to allow pre-computation. We're going to compare three variants. One's the E to T pairing, which is over a supersingular curve. We're going to do the Tate pairing over a prime characteristic curve, K equals 2, 512 bit P. And we're going to throw the 8 pairing in there as well with a 256 bit P. Again, 160-bit group size, k equals 4. This curve's a little bit more special because omega equals 2. There's a whole question about, are special curves, the more special the curve you use, are you walking into dangerous ground, right? Should you be using more general curves? I'm not going to get into that because there's actually very little done on that. Are there families of insecure pairing-friendly curves? I think the answer is probably yes, but I don't think anyone knows what they are yet, what the rules are, like you. So let's not even go there. Let's end up with some timings. Here's an RSA decryption on this platform, 1.92 milliseconds, and here's the various prices of the pairings. Of course, characteristic 2 suffers on a general purpose computer because this kind of field arithmetic isn't really supported. The Tate pairing, as I call it, with K equals 2, P equals 512, 2.91, okay, it's 50% slower. I'm using pre-computation here. I'm using everything I can, right? So on every optimization I can. The 8th pairing, a little bit disappointing, right? But it certainly benefits here. For a point multiplication over the smaller field size, it certainly benefits. So if your protocol involves a lot of point multiplication, this is possibly a better way to go. We haven't got the gains we expected here. I put that down to that fussiness thing that I talked about. Okay, there's a full paper there where this is all got into.